The MMQB podcast is brought to you by FanDuel, the leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. Enter promo code THEMMQB at FanDuel.com for a bonus match of up to $200. We're also sponsored by the SeatGeek app, the easiest way to find a great deal, pay for your tickets, and get to your seat. Download the SeatGeek app and enter our code MMQB for $20 off your first tickets. The best working relationships are the ones that center around the feeling of obligation.
I think so. I think the best relationships at all center around obligation. Let's move on to Eagles-Cowboys before I get myself in trouble here. There was a year in my early 20s when I was banned from a Dave and Buster's in Rockville, Maryland for a year.
How do they know, though? Like, if you had gone in there, how would they have known?
Thank you for joining us, as always, on the MMQB podcast. That was Andy Benoit. I'm Robert Klemko. We are writers for the MMQB, and we're here to talk football and whatever else comes up. This week, I think, Andy, you had a conversation with Peter King, so we're going to hear a little bit of that. We're going to preview our top five games of the week, but first, we like to get through the big news and notes from the weekend. No bigger news in the NFL than when there is a head coaching firing, typically. This week, we see Ken Wisenhunt dropped less than 2 years into his tenure in Tennessee. Kind of a puzzling move to some. A guy drafts a rookie quarterback, number two overall, in his second year. He's going to get at least a year to prove that that relationship is going to be fruitful. So, obviously, there's much more to the Titans dismissing Ken Wisenhunt. From your perspective, Andy, in watching the way that their team has operated on the field, did you anticipate this?
Not at all. I hope you're right that there's much more than meets the eye here, because what meets the eye is an embarrassing decision to fire a guy way too preemptively. Look at it this way. For one, Mariota did not play these last two games. So what could have possibly happened in the last 2 weeks that changed the ownership's mind and made him decide to fire Wisenhunt now and not earlier than that? Because in the games that Mariota did play, he also looked very good. And I know the Titans are not winning, and Wisenhunt's record looks deplorable. And that alone might make it an easy sell, theoretically, for ownership to make this change. But we're talking about a guy that inherited a totally different team. They knew it was a rebuilding effort. This is year two of the rebuilding effort, and really year one, because they've got the franchise quarterback now. And that franchise quarterback's been playing fantastic for him in a scheme that people didn't think would work well for him. Well, it has worked, and someone must be coaching Mariota pretty well to make it work.
You mentioned his record, Wisenhunt, 3-20 in his first two seasons, and a Jags reporter, or it was a Titans reporter, pointed out on Twitter that he's 1-20 when he doesn't have 8 months to prepare for an opponent.
That's kind of the college football argument. I live in Boise, and we see Boise State upset these big powerhouse teams, and they always do it on the opening game or in a bowl game where you have like 5 years in between contests to get ready for everybody. I get that. That's a little bit of a dig, though. Watching the Titans on film, I've never gotten the sense that this isn't – not this season. I'd have to – last year's a different story at times. But I haven't gotten the sense that this is an uncompetitive team. They're not as bad as their record would indicate.
Yeah. Well, let's move on here. I think we're in agreement there. An odd case, and I'm sure – more people will get to the bottom of the what was ailing.
Let me ask you one thing, because you have a good sense for this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We've heard the Chip Kelly rumors and all that stuff. There'll be other, we'll probably hear John Gruden rumors. If you're a high profile head coach, does the fact that this head coach, who's been to a Super Bowl before and is respected around the league, does the fact that he got fired so easily make you leery of taking the Titans job?
Well, I don't know if it was so easily. I mean, the 3-20 record is damning. I think it shed some light on, some sort of disorganization in their, in their front office or ownership or some kind of disagreement there. Because when you fire a coach less than 2 years into a job, it sheds light not only on, a poor coaching job, but poor management, a poor hire, if you will. So – But to me, when I look at this job, the number one thing that defines it is Marcus Mariota being there. So I still think it's a great job. It'll be one of the most desirable once January comes around.
Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of the QB factor in that regard.
Yeah. So let's move on to the injuries that we talk about every week. Three big ones this past Sunday. We've got Le'Veon Bell, Pittsburgh Steelers running back, tears his right MCL. He's placed on IR. Keenan Allen, the wide receiver for the Chargers, 70 receptions this year. He was second only to Julio Jones's 74 in Atlanta. He's placed on IR with a lacerated kidney. That can't feel good. Steve Smith in Baltimore, out for the season with a torn Achilles, which is really unfortunate because it might be the last we've seen of Steve Smith. Somebody on Twitter asked me today who was on my all-IR team, all-NFL IR team. And so I went through the injured reserve, and it's pretty impressive. I mean, the guys on this team, you could build a pretty solid franchise.
Yeah, I used to worry about that, thinking like, oh, this is the worst year ever for injuries. This is awful. And they are awful. They're no fun, especially a guy like Le'Veon Bell, who's, you know, that changes the scope of Pittsburgh's offense. But what I've also learned is a lot of times it just means different players become the good players then. The NFL talent level is so high that the difference between stars, I'm not going to say superstars, but stars and solid role players is not as big as you would think.
Yeah, and you also have this unending revolving market of, you know, uninjured flesh from the NCAA, these guys that are hungry because they've been playing for free for 3 years, so that doesn't hurt.
Yeah. You know what occurs to me, too? You mentioned Keenan Allen's numbers. Julio Jones, if he's leading him, he's on pace to – he might challenge Marvin Harrison's receiving record. 143 catches in a year, something like that?
Yeah, I think he's looking at 9 or 10 a game at this point, so he could get 160, presumably.
Yeah, he's been by far the best wide receiver in the NFL. Watching him on film, he's the only guy that's gotten double teamed by design, like designated doubles. Like, it's not just double by the way the coverage played out, but like we're putting two guys on him from the get go. He's gotten the most of those in the league too.
Yeah, just for gigs, can I give you my starting all IR team?
Yes, please.
Okay, Tony Romo's a quarterback, obviously.
So we're including the short designated return thing then?
Yeah. All
yeah,
IR.
Okay.
I can't decide really between Jamal Charles and Le'Veon Bell. I probably end up going with Charles.
Okay. You can put two because I think the Pro Bowl ballot has two, doesn't it? Or they're all
okay.
Pro team something.
So those are my two running backs, Thunder and Lightning.
And Bell can play wide receiver.
Okay. Well, I've got four wide receivers on the team. Kelvin Benjamin, Keenan Allen, Jordy Nelson, and Steve Smith. You can't really go wrong there.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing wrong is that we're talking about guys that are all, you know, all injured now.
Right. So my two tight ends are I'm not looking good at tight end. We've got Jason Morrow and Logan Paulson.
That's good to not look good. All right. I would take Paulson over Amaro of the two.
Okay.
Although both offenses can function without their guy. You know, these guys, that doesn't change the tenor of the offense.
Okay. I didn't see a lot of starting caliber offensive linemen. The only one that I, you know, could pick out of a hat would be Marquise Pouncey at center. The other positions, I couldn't find anybody that really jumped out at me.
Yeah, and I don't have a list of the injured guys in front of me, so I off the top of my head, I can't think of any. Did you do for defense as well?
Okay, my defense is so strong. This is like, this will be the greatest defense of all time.
I feel bad that you're taking this much joy in this all-injured team right now.
I'm not happy about it. It's just somebody asked me, and I looked it up, and I was like, wow, that'd be a great team.
Okay, all right, let's hear it.
All right, Cameron Wake is my defensive end, edge rusher. Terrell Suggs is on the other side. I want to put Charles Johnson on the field, so I'm going to have him at sort of a 3-4 defensive end type spot, even though I know he's playing out of position. Mike DeVito is an interior lineman for me, and I'll rotate in Dante Fowler and Ziggy Hood.
Okay. All right. And how about linebackers?
I've only got a couple. Alex Ogletree and Manti Te'o. I mean, we're solid there.
Is Te'o on IR, designated return?
I believe he is, yeah.
That's too big. He's had a really good season. He became their dime linebacker this year. And the book on him was that he wasn't going to be quick enough in space to play the pass and to become the dime linebacker on that team where they had Perryman, a second-round pick, and Butler, a proven veteran. That, I thought that was pretty commendable. He, to me, was the most improved linebacker in the NFL earlier this season.
Yeah, PFF agreed with you. And
I love it when that happens.
Don't you?
Yeah.
Okay, defensive backs. I've got Antoine Bethea, Orlando Scandrick, Louis Delmas, D. Milliner, and Therald Simon is my nickel.
Okay, it's nice. That's a little bit... Let me ask this. If you had to play with these guys next year, all of them coming off the injuries, mm-hmm. What do you think your team's record would be?
See, that's the real question, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what these teams have to figure out at this point now. I mean, the other thing they have to figure out, like if you're Miami, is what do you do with Cameron Wakeout? Because they've gone to this simpler defense and they've already made the coaching changes, so they committed to that. Well, you run a simple defense when you have superior personnel, and Cameron Wake had given them that. He was dominant up front. You lose that element now. You lose your edge speed. Derek Shelby becomes a guy. He's okay, but he's not Cameron Wake. So how do you change your team? Anytime you have injured guys, you got to decide what kind of team are we going to do schematically then.
Yeah, and you also have to decide if they're even worth the money at whatever diminished capability they're at. I mean, if you're asking me how good I think this team's going to be, I think we'd probably go 11-5. I've got Tony Romo, Jordy Nelson, Keenan Allen, and Kelvin Benjamin, and Jamal Charles on my offense.
Did you see what Bill Belichick said about injuries a few weeks ago?
No.
He basically said he doesn't read injury reports. He just looks for who's active and inactive. And if he's on the field, we assume he's 100%. And injury reports are complete bull and totally overrated. And why even bother to look at them?
I don't believe that Bill Belichick doesn't take into account every single piece of information.
So you think he does read the injury reports?
I think it uses it as a baseline to see if said injury is affecting the player on the film.
Well, what he did say is he does use them to determine whether they need to be more prepared possibly for the backup. To know that this dime linebacker for this team might get more snaps now because the regular linebacker's hurt or something like that.
Yeah. When did he say this? In a press conference?
Yeah, it was one of his filibuster press conferences a few weeks ago. You know, about once a month, Bill Belichick's got this reputation as a curmudgeon. He's not going to say anything to guys like us, which I understand. I don't like it, but I get it. But about once a month, he'll give some really good, insightful football stuff if you're just wanting general football nuts and bolts.
I remember the first time I was ever sent up there, I was with USA Today, and my editor just wanted me to go up there and poke around. We didn't even have any story assignments that I recall. And so I went to the press conference, and I thought, let me ask Belichick a football history question. Maybe he'll give a good answer. So it was like the third question of the press conference. I said, hey, should Ray Guy make the Hall of Fame? And he went on for about 10 straight minutes on how Ray Guy should be in the Hall of Fame because of the contribution that punters make in the NFL. And then he had time for like two more questions and then he was gone. And then I'm like 24 years old. All of these other reporters are looking at me like, you jackass,
Yeah, well, that's why you're good at your job, though, because you've got a sense for that kind. I wouldn't have thought to ask him a history question. That's a perfect type of question to ask Bill Belichick.
Yeah, but it was also the perfect question for him to avoid answering any real questions from other reporters.
Right, right.
Okay, so let's get through the rest of the news here. We've got Vernon Davis joining the Denver Broncos in a trade for 2 6th-round picks and 1 7th-round pick. In my mind, it's going to take Vernon a long time to acclimate after playing in San Francisco with Colin Kaepernick and then getting up to speed with Peyton Manning. The thing that's exciting about this to me is that now you have a second tight end that is a starter quality to pair with Virgil Green, and you can create some of those mismatches that they were able to create with Julius Thomas when he was there, to where you put Vernon Davis in line in a three-point stance, you got Virgil Green on the wing, and then an inexperienced defense is going to have a linebacker matched up against Vernon and a safety on Virgil. And a linebacker versus Vernon, I don't care how old he is, he's going to win that matchup 9 out of 10 times.
Yeah, and you could also get him detached from the formation, flip it, and put Green on the line of scrimmage and Vernon out wide, which the Niners did that quite a bit this last week against St. Louis, actually. My concern with Vernon Davis is his reputation privately around the NFL is that, great athlete, works hard at the craft, doesn't have a natural football IQ, though. And if he's coming in there, the guy he's competing with for playing time, let's assume Green stays in the lineup. Not that Green's a dynamic difference maker, but, let's assume he stays in the lineup. The guy that Davis would have to beat out then is Owen Daniels, who has spent the majority of his career in Gary Kubiak's scheme. Davis has always struggled to learn systems and learn schemes and play designs. He's not he doesn't process two pieces of information at once. He's a guy you've got to give the assignment to and let him run it in a vacuum. And I don't know how well that's going to go in the middle of the season, adjusting with a Peyton Manning and Gary Kubiak-led offense.
If I'm Vernon Davis, I'm asking Peyton Manning if I can sleep in his basement for a couple weeks and we can just watch film after he tucks his kids into bed.
Yeah, and Manning would probably acquiesce to that.
I think he would be excited about it.
Well, Vernon Davis, you're right. If he can get going, he's not, for one, we think he's old because he's been hurt and he's kind of disappeared. I think he's barely into his 30s, though. He's not a geezer.
Yeah, he's 31.
So if you can get him going, you're right. You do have the Julius Thomas mismatch factor back in your favor, and that was a big piece to their offense last year and one that they've really missed.
Let's cover real quick another 49ers topic. The team benches Colin Kaepernick and it plans to start Blaine Gabbert against the Falcons this week. You'll remember Blaine Gabbert from his action in 2003 as a starter. After three losses, he's benched. He threw for 481 yards, one touchdown, and seven interceptions. Before I get your take on that, I just want to comment on what an incredible thing it is that Mike Mularkey is an NFL head coach again in Tennessee, and Blaine Gabbert is a starting NFL quarterback again. It's 2012.
It's hard to find. Those are the two most important parts of a franchise and probably the two most difficult positions and areas to fill.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on why this move was made and what it means for Kaepernick in the future?
Well, I've watched every snap on film, and I got to the Rams Niners quickly this week in order to – because I wanted to scratch this itch about this question, and I'll cut right to the chase. If they were to put him back in the lineup now with the way he's playing, they'd run the risk of losing the locker room because it's such basic. For one, the offense has been so watered down and simplified for a variety of reasons, not just him, but largely him. And for two, even at the simplification, he's not executing the most basic of quarterbacking standards. He can't play the position right now. He's wide-eyed and snake-bit, and it's harmful to the team. And when one guy's playing that poorly as a coaching staff, it's hard to ask the other 21 guys on the field, hey, bust your ass for us, because you're not giving them the best chance to win in that case.
Yeah. It's crazy to think that a guy who seemed to be so calm and collected and was able to take the job from Alex Smith and make your starting quarterback for a number of years expendable in the way that he did so quickly in 2012 is now classified as snake bit. What a pressure-filled league this is. Before we get to the previews, I want to tell you guys a little bit about one of our sponsors, SeatGeek. We all like to watch sports from the convenience of our living rooms and laptops, but the way to truly make memories with sports is to go see a game in person. Go make some memories of your own and do it with the SeatGeek app. Now, when you use the code MMQB, you get a check back for $20. Here's how it works. You download the SeatGeek app on your iPhone or Android. It's free and takes less than a minute to download. Then you search for your event. Find a great deal. Enter our code MMQB. And when you complete your purchase, SeatGeek will send a $20 check to your house. It's that easy. It pulls in ticket options from hundreds of sellers online and shows you the best deals automatically. When you shop on SeatGeek, you're seeing virtually every ticket option available all on one page. They also have a feature called Deal Score. It ranks every ticket on the market with a value score and plots the best deals on a color-coded map of the venue. Finally, SeatGeek's mobile app makes the ticket buying process seamless, easy, and safe. On SeatGeek, you can store your credit card, and once you find a ticket you want to buy, you can make the purchases with two quick taps of your phone. There's no faster way to buy tickets. So to redeem your promo code and get back your $20 check, download the free SeatGeek app, enter the promo code MMQB. SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've made your first purchase. Andy, what did you and Peter talk about?
Well, we talked about the trade deadline and not the specifics of it so much, but just, you know, the wisdom of Peter King from the perspective of the trade deadline and behind the curtains at his NBC gig. Okay, Peter, I want to talk to you about the trade deadline and not so much the specifics of it, but kind of in general. I remember you and I were on the road for some training camp stuff, I think it was, a few years ago, and there was a team in need of a tight end, and you were kind of not playing the go-between, but sharing the information with other teams, saying, hey, put the word out, let them know we're looking, we might be interested. How often do you do that kind of thing, and how much of that sort of discussion is going on around the league during the trade deadline time?
Well, I do think that people in the media are used sometimes around the time of the trading deadline, probably me less than I used to, because I don't necessarily cover the league the way I did, say, 15 years ago when the day of the trading deadline, I'd make 15 phone calls to see if anybody was talking to anybody else and really try to follow it. But I don't do it as much now because, you know, I'm running our website and doing some other things. So, but I think what happens, Andy, is that, and this is going to sound a little bit strange or a little bit flying by the seat of your pants, but I think what happens mostly around the time of the trading deadline is teams that are at the bottom of the standings are trying to get draft choices. And it's the biggest reason why I think, and I've thought this for a long time, that the trading deadline shouldn't be after week 8. It should be after week 12. It's very hard if you're John Harbaugh, Ozzie Newsome, and the people who run the Baltimore Ravens. It's very hard to say to your fans, look, I know we're 2-6. We get 8 games to go, but we're trading, you know, pick a guy. We're trading Osamele and, you know, Dennis Pitta. He's coming back, but we're trading him. Or we're trading 3 veterans to get some low round picks next year in the draft. Fans don't want to hear that. But I do think that once it has become almost assumed and automatic that you're definitely out of it, I do think your fans would rather have you play for next year. So if the St. Louis Rams, for instance, are out of it after week 12, I think they'd say, well, go ahead, trade Jared Cook. That's fine with us. Or, you know, I think teams are going to be more aggressive sellers in week 12 than they are in week 8. And that's why I think the trading deadline, it's a big, big mistake to have the trading deadline now. It used to be after week 6, as you know. Mm-hmm. I just think it's a big mistake. But as far as being used, yeah. I mean, I'm used sometimes, and I know that I've been used. I was used in training camp. I knew I was being used. And I can't be all that specific other than to say there was a team that really wanted a wide receiver. And I wrote a couple of things about it. Not that this team wanted a wide receiver, but that, you know, there's a team in the NFL that needs a wide receiver and may be willing to pay handsomely for it. I just sort of hinted at that. So that normally maybe a general manager in the league who I know pretty well might pick up the phone and say, maybe give me an idea of what you're talking about in any way that I think we might have a spare wide receiver when we get to the end of training camp. You know, those are the kind of things that happen. And I never mind doing that. Because what ends up happening, Andy, is that once in a while you get to feel or you get to see that certain teams are in the market for a certain position, and maybe you didn't know that. So just overall, it gives you a little bit of intelligence that you may not normally have had.
keep taking us behind the curtain like this, because I think people, I find this really interesting, and I'm sure our listeners do as well. Tell us, what's the NBC studio like? What's your day? I know you weren't there this past week, but what's your day typically like on a Sunday, and particularly when you're at NBC?
Well, what happens, Andy, is that I get to the NBC studios at about noon Eastern time, and we're in a viewing room, and the viewing room consists of nine televisions in a big rectangular block at the front of the room, nine high-def screens, and then to one side there is a 10th screen, because sometimes there are 10 games in that early East Coast 1 o'clock window. So the games go on. In the front row, there's Tony Dungy, Rodney Harrison, Mike Florio, me, some other people from the show, Elliot Calve with the stats. In the second row, there's a lot of the production people. And so we basically watch all of the first games. And while those games go on, if there's a really big play in one of the games that Tony and Rodney might want to use as a game they're going to diagram on the Telestrator, they will watch that play over and over again, and they'll say, okay, yeah, this is the play we want to use. So that happens, and then there's just general discussion also about how we're going to do the show that night. And for instance, if there's some bit of news that Mike Florio and I want to use on the show, we'll discuss that at some point in that 3-hour window. At the end of the 3 hours, you know, what I find really interesting and really helpful for me, Andy, is that if something happens, and I'll give you a good example, like the day that Charles Woodson intercepted Peyton Manning. We weren't in the viewing room then. We were out on the set at that point. But Rodney Harrison sometimes has some of the greatest just offhanded comments. And we're out there, we're getting prepared for the 7 o'clock Eastern time show. And Rodney Harrison just says, you know, almost out of the blue, when he ended up saying it on the show, but he says that I think Charles Woodson's the greatest defensive back of all time. And that hit me right between the eyes. Hit me right. I just could not believe that he was so matter of fact and so absolute about it. And you think of, you go way back, you go to Emlyn Tennell, you go to Night Train Lane, you go to Ronnie Lott, you go to Larry Wilson, you go to Deion Sanders, and you just say, wow, that is an incredible statement. I ended up talking to him about it and used it in Monday Morning Quarterback the next day, because I thought it was such an extraordinary statement. But I learn a lot, and you learn a lot too, just asking Tony Dungy sometimes about coaching decisions that he has made and how you would determine, not just on the field, but, you know, Tony, what do you think of this controversy? Or I wish I could think of an example, but it's just extremely educational to be able to sit there and to have such good, strong resources with you to be able to watch the games together.
How into the games does everybody get from a fan standpoint? I mean, is there any cheering ever?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we go nuts. It's like I can really act more like a fan watching these games and yelling at the TV than I could if I were in the press box of the games. When I'm in the press box, I might say, oh, that's so, what a dumb play or a dumb call, whatever. But I would never be demonstrative because you're a professional. But it's funny, when you're just watching the games in there and you're a fan, Rodney Harrison is like, he gets really exercised sometimes. It's funny to hear him yell at the TV the way any normal fan would. And I do the exact same thing. I'll scream, what are you doing, Jim Caldwell? Why did you call that? You know, so, but it's fun to be able to look at guys who you'd never just get to sit down and watch a football game with Tony Dungy or Rodney Harrison. And that's really about the most fun thing of all, that you get to hear their expertise what's really fun, what you would enjoy, Andy, is just really hearing and listening to Dungy and Rodney talking about coverage sometimes and whose fault certain things are. You know, it's just, it's really educational to me from sort of a game knowledge standpoint. I really enjoy it.
Peter, this was fun. We always appreciate it. Anytime we can get to go behind the curtain with you.
Thanks a lot, Andy. Much appreciated.
You know, I've always wondered what Peter is like behind the scenes at NBC. I wonder if he makes as many fart jokes as he does with us.
Yeah, or if he belches as often as he does around us.
Yeah.
It's incredible. He's incredible at it. We're going to get to the game previews in a second. First of all, I want to tell you about FanDuel. The NFL regular season is halfway done. In the old days, your chance to play fantasy football was long gone. You were probably out of your league and not even activating some of the guys on your roster by that point. Now you can join thousands of leagues on FanDuel. They cost as little as $1 to enter, and you can cash out in the very same night that you win. Every day is a new day with FanDuel. Bonus match of up to $200 when you use the promo code THEMNQB. FanDuel's the leader in one-week fantasy football. There's more winners and more payouts than any other site. $75 million a week this season worth of payouts. Go to FanDuel.com, click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner, use the code THEMNQB, and sign up now. And here's that special offer for new users. We mentioned it. For the first 50 people that use that promo code THEMNQB, you get your $200 matched on FanDuel. It's also, you got daily fantasy football, basketball, baseball, and hockey on FanDuel. So find out why daily fantasy sports have become wildly popular. Do it with FanDuel.com, promo code THEMNQB.
All right, so let's run through our five games that we're excited about. It's always nice at this point of year to narrow down the contenders from the pretenders, and we've got 10 teams that we think could make an impact in the postseason. The first game being Broncos at Colts. This is big for the simple fact that it's Manning versus Luck. It's Manning's return to Indianapolis once again. The Broncos, though, in much better shape than the Colts these days. The Broncos are 7-0, Indianapolis 3-5, coming off the overtime loss to Carolina. Andrew Luck leads the league with 12 interceptions despite missing two games. Is it time to throw Matt Hasselbeck in there and perhaps get Andrew healthy if he is actually being bothered by some sort of rib injury?
Is this like a trick question?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, no. If Andrew Luck throws another 30 interceptions, you don't bench him. You know, there's certain guys you don't bench in the NFL. And if there's any lack of clarity about that, look at the end of the Panthers game. Andrew Luck was having his worst game as an NFL quarterback, maybe even since his high school days or ever. And the game, look what he did in the final quarter of it. Not that he's got this magic at the end of games, but guys that good are capable of going off at any time. And there's not a chance you ever bench Andrew Luck for anything other than the fact that injuries prevent him from playing.
Now, what if injuries prevent him from playing well or put him at risk for further injury?
The first one, I don't think you can evaluate that. I mean, guys are going to be limited all the time. The second one, that's a discussion. If you don't want to risk him for further injury. All right, let me put it this way. If there's no way you ever bench Andrew Luck for anything other than and only health concerns.
My problem with the way Andrew is playing is that we're at the point where you can't really blame it on his surroundings. I mean, he's got a strong running game. Frank Gore is producing just the same as he was during his heyday in San Francisco, 4.3 yards per carry. The offensive weapons aren't great, but Kobe Fleener is a nice receiving tight end. T.Y. Hilton's out there. I watched the game the other night, the glaring thing about the offense was just bad decisions by Andrew Luck.
Oh, no question. He made some really bad decisions in that game. And his greatest strength becomes his greatest weakness, and that is the ability to extend plays and throw with bodies around him or sometimes even draping off of him. And at times he pushes that envelope too far and the ball gets turned over, and I'm sure that's something that he is adamant about working on and that Pep Hamilton, his offensive coordinator, is adamant about working on. But having said all that, you can still, there's still more you can do. That a guy like that makes the guys around him better. When those plays are not being intercepted, and let's assume they're not going to continue to be picked off all the time because they haven't been through the first three seasons of his career. When you have a guy that can do that and get the full value out of every snap like that, then it almost doesn't matter who is around him because he can elevate the guys around. It's the same thing with Aaron Rodgers. So I like Andrew Luck. I think his offensive line starting to play a little better as well for him. I wouldn't be surprised to see the Colts turn this around and go, what, they're 3-5 now. If they went 5-3 in the second half of the season, even 6-2, that would certainly win the AFC South, and I wouldn't be surprised to see it go that way.
Yeah, I mean, they're still in first place in the division. The Titans just fired their head coach. They have one win, and they're 1.5 games out of the lead.
Yeah, and has a head coach ever been fired being 1.5 games out of first place after Halloween?
I'm sure it's happened. Let's move on to Denver's opponent last week, Packers at Carolina. This is a matchup of two teams that were both undefeated as recent as last week. The Packers now 6-1. Carolina, a surprising 7-0, perhaps the most surprising undefeated team of the four in the NFL. In your mind, do the Panthers have the type of personnel in Josh Norman, Charles Tillman, Ben Wickery, much like the Broncos, to cover the Packers' wideouts for, you know, the 4 or 5 seconds necessary?
Well, in a literal sense of the question, yes, because those guys are playing zone, and so, you know, you can stay in zone a while. Now, if what happens with zone, if you get late in the down like that, is the zones naturally expand and they tend to break down. Zone coverage is designed to last for about 3.5 seconds tops. So, you know, if they give Rodgers, if he gets a ton of time, Green Bay will have success. It's a different offense versus defense matchup too, because Denver is so good at man coverage. And as I wrote about this week, Green Bay is not good against man coverage, not in tactically anyway. They rely on guys to win individual matchups. Well, this week, when you go spread sets like Green Bay does, those individual matchups are different because of the zone technique. So anyway, long story short, there will be more throwing windows for Rodgers this week. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy, but they're not going to have 50 yards net passing again.
Yeah. On the other side of the ball, I think the Packers have a chance to replicate some of the success that Indianapolis had in knocking around Cam Newton. The tackle play hasn't been great in Carolina, and Green Bay's pass rush has been one of their strong suits. Do you think that they're able to get to him?
Yeah, because the other thing, Green Bay does a very good job with inside blitzes. That's the Dom Capers factor. It's the old Fire X blitz out of the 3-4 zone blitzing stuff where the linebackers explode in there. Clay Matthews is the guy they use, and Carolina's got injuries and very average personnel because of the injuries in the interior offensive line right now.
Let's move on to Rams at Vikings. I watched the Vikings game from the press box in Chicago this weekend. They were impressive in spurts. The one thing that I think that they have trouble with is some of the predictability of their offense. You know that they're not going to be able to run effectively out of shotgun. And you know that most of the time when they're in single back and there's anybody set up as a lead blocker, whether it's a offset tight end or the rare occasion when it's Zach Lyon, you know it's going to be a run with Adrian Peterson. To me, it's just not a creative look on offense, and I think it's one that's going to struggle against the Rams.
Yeah, it could. Peterson's much better running out of the I formation than he is. You wrote about that, didn't you,
a few weeks
ago?
Yeah.
He's much better out of the I formation than out of shotgun. And I would expect to see more I formation stuff for two reasons. One, because of that, Peterson's good at it. Three reasons, really. Two is when you run I formation, it's easier to set up double teams at the point of attack, inside double teams. And they're going to need to do that against those Rams defensive tackles, Brockers and Aaron Donald. And then three is you get a play action element, a downfield play action element, which Norv Turner loves. He loves to stretch the field to about the 20-yard range out of play action. You get that when you go under center with I formation. Let me ask you, in that Bears-Vikings game, which locker room did you go into afterwards?
Let me think. Oh, I went to the Vikings locker room.
Do you like the winning locker room more than the losing one?
It depends on if I know people in the losing one, because I can get stuff out of the guys that I have a relationship with, because then they feel obligated to at least give a half decent interview because they know me. But if it's a losing locker room and I don't know anybody in there, I stay as far away as I can.
the best relationships, working relationships, are the ones that center around the feeling of obligation.
I think so. I think the best relationships at all center around obligation. Let's move on to Eagles-Cowboys before I get myself in trouble here. The Cowboys have recently cut ties with Joseph Randall 4 days after Randall was found to have violated the league's personal conduct policy for a recent arrest in Wichita. Have you been to Wichita before?
No, but one time at the Boise Grove Hotel when I was in junior high, I was filming my own version of the Tom Green Show with my buddy. And we went in there just hindering people, bothering them. And my storyline was I was at the hotel because I was from Wichita.
That is so bizarre.
Yeah.
That whole thing is just bizarre.
Yeah, and we got the best reaction you can get from the security guard, which was we were told to leave the premises. I always like it when the word premises gets involved. I mean, I did back then. Now if I do it, you know, that's awkward. But back then, anytime you were told, like, it was fun as a kid to grow up and have certain areas you could tell your friends, hey, I'm not allowed to go there. I'm banned from that place.
There was a year in my early 20s when I was banned from a Dave & Buster's in Rockville, Maryland for a year.
How do they know that, like, if you'd gone in there, how would they have known?
I don't know that. I think I probably could have gone back in there, but I guess it's like if I go back in and get in trouble again, then I'm in more trouble because I was banned.
But would you really be like, if you got in, like, say you got in legal trouble, would they be able to, like, add that to it? Like, well, not only did the guy, you know, it was a guy drunk and disorderly, but he was also told not to come back here. Can we up the charges, officer?
I guess it would be trespassing. That would be the added
charge.
Oh,
okay. There we go. I had an answer for that. Good. Yeah. Joseph Randall, by the way, I was wrong about him, and I think there's more going on than what we're seeing on the field there.
Yeah, okay. So his replacement in the past 2 weeks, Darren McFadden, 57 total touches for 275 yards. This is something we've seen from Darren McFadden, spurts of effectiveness throughout his career.
He's a good straight line runner. He has no lateral agility, but in a zone scheme, that's not the worst thing. We saw DeMarco Murray put up big numbers in this zone scheme last year. You find the hole and you hit it. As people know, I didn't feel Murray always did that. I think McFadden's a guy that does do that. There's a physicality to it. We think of him as a delicate guy. He's got kind of the Fred Taylor type injury bug, but there's a physicality to him when he's running right. And the last 2 weeks, especially 2 weeks ago, he has been running right.
Yeah. The last of the five games we're going to get to, Raiders at Steelers. This is a game that's near and dear to my heart because, you know, I grew up in a Raiders family, and people are talking about the Raiders as contenders now, which is kind of exciting. They're second place in the AFC West, and there's no one-loss teams in the AFC West. You're either undefeated or 4-3. Derek Carr in his last two games, 47 of 67, 622 yards, 7 touchdowns, no picks. There's only a handful of guys playing football better than Derek Carr is right now. What has been the key in your mind to the success that they've been having on offense?
Well, Bill Musgrave, the offensive coordinator, trusts Derek Carr. And because of that, they stay aggressive in moments where teams don't always stay aggressive. And they do a ton of different stuff, a lot of different formations. They've probably got I wrote this week for MQB, I think they have the most diverse offense in the NFL. They are deep at tight end and fullback. They're not dynamic here. They don't have, like, superstars at these positions, but they've got a lot of guys who can do a lot of different things. And Musgrave's done a very good job taking advantage of that. The other thing they're doing is more pre-snap motion. So the formations that they have shown now have new added wrinkles to them. And what's good about motion is you don't have to change a lot in practice. You can run the same plays just with more motion concepts, theoretically. I mean, it's some tweaks, but you don't have to overhaul anything to add motion to it, and it gives the defense a lot more to think about. So if the Raiders are expanding the way they are now, if they keep growing offensively with their scheme, they will be a top five offense in terms of difficulty to play against by the end of this season.
Yeah, quietly, this is, you know, one of the bigger games of the year. Both of these teams in a very similar situation. The Steelers have the Bengals leading that division at 7-0. They're 4-4. The Raiders 4-3. The Broncos 7-0. I mean,
the Jets Patriots are the same thing too. It's AFC's lopsided to the top, and it's going to be a dogfight at the in the middle pack
for those wild card spots.
Yeah. Can I say dogfight on a on a game where Michael Vick's still part of the team?
Well, I don't think anybody would have noticed until you brought it up.
All right. Sorry.
On the other side of the ball, before we have to leave here, Martavis Bryant in Pittsburgh accounted for only 12% of the Steelers' targets last season. This year, he's already seen over 25%. Some of that is a function of, you know, how well he's playing, but I think a lot of it is necessity. I mean, now you're talking about not having Le'Veon Bell, so all the hits that they've taken on offense, I think, has changed the shape of it.
And it's going to have to keep changing the shape because that Le'Veon Bell injury is enormous. And D'Angelo Williams played well early in the year. The plan was for him to play those two games as the guy. They didn't bring him in to be the guy. They have to roll with it now. I would expect to see more spread stuff, though, and have the running game. And the problem is Bell was very good in the spread offense because he can go to the slot as a wide receiver. But I think you still spread out and extend the running game to wide receiver screens. Get the ball in Bryant's hands quickly and certainly Antonio Brown's hands quickly and transfer five carries of Williams over to five screen passes for the wide receivers.
Yeah. Well, we like to close our show with our non-football recommended reading. Do you you got anything for this week?
I do. I read an article by Nicholas Schmidl of the New Yorker, and it was about Syrian refugees and the epic story of one refugee's epic escape from Syria.
I saw that one. That's a great story.
It was. It read like, and not that I don't mean to make light of it. It read like an adventure novel, though. Like from the writing standpoint, it really carried you through the pages. And I'll be honest, I read a lot about the Middle East, but I don't relate to it at all well because, you know, I've never been in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Some of it can feel dry and boring at times. This was not at all the case. And it was very relatable. I could picture being a refugee in the United States. I could visualize it based on the way they described it here in Syria.
The tough thing about making a story flow like that and making it feel like a novel is getting people to remember details about their lives that they didn't think were important at the time.
Interesting, yeah.
And that story is awesome that way. My recommended read, I'm going to cheat a little bit here because it's not going to be non-football. It's my 5,000-word tome on Benton Harbor High School football in Michigan and the turnaround there fostered by a former Division I head coach. I recommend you read it. I obviously read it because
You're recommending your own writing here.
Yeah, that's what just happened.
Okay. Very good. That's fair game because if you did that every week, it would lose credence. But you're recommended some other stuff too, so I assume you're very happy with how this piece came out.
Yeah, and it's long as hell. I mean, I'm not going to recommend something I wrote that's like 800 words. This is like 5,000.
How long did it take you?
About 12 hours.
Did you sit in bed when you wrote it, like you did at the Super Bowl?
No, I was at a
the sheets all day long.
I was in a little diner in Benton Harbor, Michigan.
Very good. Yeah. Good. I will check it out then. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. This has been the MMQB podcast. Next week, we'll get to your Twitter questions. Feel free to tweet us at #MMQBpodcast. Thanks to our producer, Dan Bloom, our researcher extraordinaire, John Daigle. Until next week, I'm Robert Klemko. That's Andy Benoit. See you later.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.